The next case is 0756, John K. O'Toole, Administrator versus William Denahan. Ms. Sheehan.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Michelle Sheehan. I represent the Cuyahoga County Department of Children and Family Services, its Executive Director William Denahan, and caseworker Kamisha Duncan. The co-defendant and I have divided our time and respectfully request 2 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, this case stands for several inconsistent and inaccurate propositions of law. First, it expands the duties of the Ohio reporting statutes and creates new duties that the statute does not obligate. Two, it also requires all social workers that investigate allegations of abuse to be subject to the in loco parentis statute. Third, it abolishes government immunity for an executive director's policymaking, planning, and enforcement decisions. And fourth, as Mr. Cochran will explain, it imposes individual liability on social workers for essentially negligent investigation allegations. With regard to the reporting statute, it is undisputed that the purpose of the reporting statute is to initiate an investigation, and that is exactly what occurred in this case. The daycare center notified DCFS of a potential allegation of abuse, and they immediately investigated. The Court of Appeals, however, has added two additional requirements to the statute. First, they now require social workers and DCFS to report reported allegations of abuse, so that if they receive a report, they have to report it a second time. And second, while the statute says that reports shall be made to either DCFS or the police, the Court of Appeals in this case interpreted the word or to mean and now requires social workers and DCFS to report only to the police. Both requirements are expand the duty of the Ohio reporting statute and impose additional obligations on DCFS and its employees. With regard to the in loco parentis statute, again, this holding essentially holds that social workers, when they investigate an allegation of abuse, they now have a heightened duty, an obligation to stand in the shoes of a parent towards the person that they are investigating the abuse for. This proposition alone would shut down every DCFS in the state of Ohio. Even plaintiff's watered down version that in this case, the social worker stopped the mother and stopped the child and asked questions still doesn't rise to the level of custody that is required in the in loco parentis statute.
Assuming that we are convinced of your argument on the reporting issue and on the local parentis issue, the no local parentis and there's no requirement here to report because of the statute is disjunctive. Is there still, this is a case we decided on summary judgment, and that's the only thing that bothers me here, frankly, because there seems to be a pretty strong difference of opinion, at least as I read the briefs, about Ms. Duncan's or the caseworkers, what she viewed and her conclusions about the child. Is there still something to be decided on the question, on the factual issue of willful and wanton and that issue for the jury?
No, Your Honor, and that's because, as this court held in Marshall, there is no allegation or there is immunity for negligent investigation. What this case now holds is that in Marshall, there was no individual allegation against the social workers.
Right.
So we're actually going in the back door instead of the front door and alleging a reckless investigation against the individuals to create individual liability. So it was properly decided on summary judgment as the entity and the individuals did not violate a statute and they're entitled to immunity. When it comes to the reckless argument, it was still properly decided, it was still properly decided on summary judgment because the actions involved do not rise to the level of recklessness.
And that's a that's a factual determination, is it not? I mean, it's based on facts, at least. It's ultimately a legal determination, but there are conflicting facts, are there not, on that issue, and whether the at least the individual's conduct here was negligence or reckless?
Your Honor, it as a matter of law, under these facts, the actions do not rise to the level of recklessness. And without stamping completely on my co-defendant's argument, because his entire argument focuses on this issue and what is the definition of recklessness, and is it just something greater than negligence, or does it require a greater intentional act, a disregard of a known risk? So with that, I would ask that my, I would turn over the remainder of the argument to Mr. Cochran.
Thank you, Ms. Sheehan. Mr. Cochran.
Chief Justice and Justice of the Supreme Court, my name is Jim Cochran. I represent the appellate Talis Monroe, who was the supervisor in the investigation unit in this matter. And I'm here to discuss with the court the proposition that, in the first instance, that Mr. Monroe was not reckless in the way that he performed his duties, but probably more importantly, asking this court to give clear guidance to the lower courts on how to analyze a situation of recklessness when a governmental worker is charged that he has committed his acts in a reckless fashion. As the court is aware, the only way that an employee in a governmental function in the state of Ohio can be held liable is if he is stripped of his immunity. 2744.03A6 says that all employees have that immunity. There are three exceptions. One of the exceptions is subsection B, and what has been alleged here is that Mr. Monroe acted in wanton or reckless manner such that he would be stripped of his immunity. Now, the danger in this case, as I have seen it, is that the plaintiffs have made a number of allegations that there was a lapse of care in the case. And what they've attempted to do is by saying that there are more than a number of negligent components or allegations should bring the case to the level where the trier of fact decides whether or not it is a reckless conduct or negligent conduct. That is a dangerous proposition for all employees in the state of Ohio. As this court is aware, since Marshall versus Montgomery, Board of Children and Family Services, the entity in these cases cannot be held liable for failing to investigate. Now, you have Mr. Monroe and some of these other social workers who have to perform the duties to actually do the investigations, and they could be subject to liability where the entity has no responsibility in that regard. What we are asking the court to determine is not to abdicate the function to the jury as to whether it's reckless or negligence, but to come to some clear understanding as to what the legal duty is for the employee. Now, in this case, there's legislative authority and provisions of the Ohio Administrative Code that show what should happen in an investigation. And if you compare that to the conduct of Mr. Monroe, he did perform those functions. But once you get to that level, the court needs to make a legal determination as to whether or not the duty was violated. First, what is the duty? Was the duty violated? It's our proposition that you can't leave that standard to the jury, because when you do that, you've kind of fallen back into a negligence standard, allowing the jury to decide what the duty is.
Mr. Cochran, though, building on the Chief Justice's question, this is at summary judgment, and we all know that a decision on summary judgment short-circuits a case entirely from a jury and determines that the issues are not, there are no material issues of fact entitling the moving party, if summary judgment is granted, as a matter of law, this is what should happen. But here we have two differing interpretations of the facts, and shouldn't that be an issue for the jury to conclude whether there was recklessness, whether there was not recklessness, and then of course, if the recklessness is not shown, your client would still retain immunity. Question is, who strips the immunity from the defendant? Should it be the judge looking at the situation as a matter of law, or should it be a jury when there are disputed issues of fact?
Your Honor, we feel that there's actually two functions that the court has to perform and one function that the jury performs. The court has to determine whether or not there is a duty and the duty has been violated. It acts as a gatekeeper function. Then it must decide if there's sufficient evidence of the record to show that there is an animus for the actor which would rise it to the level of a perverse disregard for a known risk. If the court makes that determination, then it should overrule summary judgment. But in this case, that determination was never made. The Court of Appeals analysis does not go that far. Now, if the analysis is made that summary judgment is not appropriate because those two factors are present in the case, that is, a clear legal duty was violated, and that there is evidence that there was an improper animus in the case, wanton or reckless conduct, then the jury must make the decision whether or not those are facts that would lead them to believe that that has occurred. Your Honors, I would like to reserve any other additional time that's in my argument for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Cochran. Ms. Pettinelli.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I am Joan Pettinelli, and along with co-counsel, represent appellee John K. O'Toole, the representative and administrator for the estate of Sidney Sawyer. Sidney Sawyer was an innocent four-year-old little girl who was repeatedly abused in her own home. Her abuse was reported to DCFS on March 29th of 2000 by the nurse at the daycare she attended, a mandatory reporter under the statute. Monroe and Duncan, the supervisor and the caseworker in this case, believed, or at the very least, suspected that these serious physical injuries to this child emanated from abuse. Despite that belief and despite other compelling evidence, despite that their belief, as documented in the file, that her safety was of immediate concern, they returned this child to the same environment, to the status quo. Almost 30 days, and they never saw her again. Duncan saw her one time on the very first visit. Almost 30 days later, she died from physical abuse. DCFS and its employees asked this court to find that they are not accountable for the wrongdoing by statutory immunity. We asked the court to affirm the Court of Appeals decision and remand
Counsel,
for trial.
During that time period from when this child was returned to the mother's home and her death, was the Department of Family Services conducting an investigation? Were they doing any more work on this case?
Well, Your Honor, I think the argument would be by DCFS that they were. There was very little in the record to support that. They did institute what's called a safety plan. However, that safety plan was instituted in violation of even DCFS internal policy, did not contain required components, was developed outside just by the caseworker and the supervisor, was developed outside the required staffing in this case because we had severe injuries and we had an unknown perpetrator. So no, Your Honor, there may have been some attempts to gather information that were not followed up upon.
And there was no law enforcement component here?
There was no law enforcement component. And that brings me to the first of the two immunity exceptions that we're arguing in this case. The first is, as it applies to both DCFS and its employees, is the duty to report. 2151.421A of the revised code expressly imposes liability within the meaning of the immunity statute for the failure to report known or suspected abuse of a child. It's our view and our position in this case that DCFS, when it and these employees knew or suspected the abuse to Sidney Sawyer, that they had an affirmative duty under the statute to report that information to the police.
What do we do with the word or in the statute?
Your Honor, we recognize that the word or is in the statute. However, the statute could not have meaning for administrators and employees of a children public services agency to be even be in there as mandatory reporters if they're only required to report to themselves. It makes no sense. What does make sense is that they be required to report to the police, because since I think 1965, the statute was enacted in 1963, since 1965, there's always been a duty when a report is made and an investigation is conducted, that investigation has to take place in coordination and cooperation with law enforcement.
Your argument would be much stronger if they hadn't done anything. But here they developed a plan, and they set forth three elements that they were going to investigate. And the idea of unification of the mother and the child was the goal, with security measures in place. And so the information and the duty to report came to them. And as the chief points out, the statute is disjunctive.
The statute is disjunctive.
And they took the information seriously and made reasonable efforts, in their view, about instilling some security into that family situation.
Your Honor, it's our view that their efforts were not reasonable. They were, in fact, reckless. That safety plan that the court referenced did not contain required components that would do anything really significantly to monitor this child's progress for whatever period of time they were going to leave this case open. It did not require that anyone who had contact with the child on a daily basis to report in any problems. All it required was that she remain enrolled in school, albeit it indicated, I believe, that, or there's a suggestion that the daycare would report any suspicious or unexplained marks.
Well, counsel, isn't that your argument for the first, when you read that statute, the first reporting requirement would be for a mandatory reporter to report, and that individual has two choices, one to Department of Family Services or the police. And since the mandatory reporter reported to the Family Services, your argument was that they then, based on their investigation, their suspicions, or actually confirmation of this child being abused, that same statute required them then to go to the police. That's what basically what you're saying here.
Yes, Your Honor, and by all means, we do not mean to suggest that a DCFS employee, when it receives a phone call on the hotline of a neighbor saying, I think my neighbor is abusing her child, that information directly has to be reported to the police. It is once that employee of DCFS looks at the situation and makes a determination, I know there's abuse here, I've seen it myself directly, or I suspect abuse, or that this child is facing the threat of future abuse.
And where do you find support for that in the statute? I know that's your argument, but
I find that support for that in the very first paragraph of 2151.421A1A. And that is that no person who's described in the statute shall fail to immediately report.
And the description that is of all these persons who would come in contact with children, a lawyer, a teacher, a social worker, and it also, as you argue, it also includes a certified child service care agency, child care service agency. And their argument is that that's if a social worker working for the agency finds that totally unrelated perhaps to the case she is on, that she detects some abuse. And at that point, then the social worker would have, or the worker would have, the responsibility to report to the police agency.
Your Honor, I understand that is the argument that they've made. I don't think there's any meaningful investigation. Does it really matter if a social worker whose job it is to investigate claims of abuse and to protect the child where necessary is out on her own case, or she sees another child in the home who is at risk or potentially at risk or has been abused, or if she's out investigating other witnesses, talking with other witnesses and sees evidence of abuse and suspects abuse in that situation. I don't think it matters, Your Honor, what position that they're in. If they are acting in their official capacity, as the statute says, then they are required to make that report to the police. And another part of the reason, Your Honor, is because that this these investigations are to be carried out in coordination and cooperation with the police. That cooperation cannot possibly occur unless the police are notified.
Did your complaint argue recklessness on the part of the employees of the agency?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's part of the complaint. And this came in, it was resolved on a summary judgment. What were the factual issues with respect to the conduct of those employees in terms of your argument on wanton or reckless?
There were different arguments, Your Honor, as regarding the supervisor and the caseworker versus William Denahan, the recklessness of Mr. Denahan and his liability and his individual capacity. I would like to point out to the court that Mr. Denahan's individual liability for recklessness is not before the court. That is not an issue that the court has decided to accept. I will address and would be glad to address that so far as it impacts the county, but I think the court's question might be more directed to the caseworker and supervisor. In this case, Your Honor, they believed that this child was being abused in her own home. They immediately, and Mr. Monroe, even in a memo, stated that he immediately recognized the injury to this child's face to be basically the imprint of a fist. They knew that the mother was hostile. Although there's some dispute in the record by Ms. Duncan in her testimony versus her testimony in the criminal trial, the mother was hostile, uncooperative, wanted to take this child home. They knew that the nature of the injury and documented in the case file suggested that her safety is of immediate concern. And they knew within days of the investigation that the mother either called and asked permission or allegedly took her out of the state. The problem here is that there was a live-in boyfriend. No one ever talked to him. No one ever talked to the biological parent, the father. No one ever looked into information that was readily available in the daycare records as to who her relatives were. They failed to follow departmental policy and the Ohio Administrative Code. They never contacted the police, which we believe, Your Honor, is a factor. It's a separate basis for the failure to report, but it's also a factor in the recklessness of these individuals. They were required to conduct face-to-face interviews of all adults living with the child. They did not do that. They were required to hold a staffing.
Counsel, is there a dispute here as to any of the things that you're telling us? And I think that's what Justice O'Donnell was asking. The records that you're saying very clearly indicate that they failed to do all these things. Are they saying either that they did do them or they did some of them, or that the conclusions you're drawing based on these facts, if we do agree that these facts are true, they still don't rise to the level of the allegations of the complaint?
I think largely, Your Honor, they are undisputed that these failures occurred. There are some disputes, obviously, whether the safety plan was adequate, whether Mr. Monroe believed that his unit chief approval was required, whether he believed he could do this outside of a staffing. However, the county's own position when they terminated him was that a staffing was required in this case. You didn't do that. So there are a number of facts that suggest, strongly suggest, that not only was their conduct negligent, but it was reckless and in violation.
So just so I understand, there's no dispute as to the facts. What you're disputing is whether or not this conglomeration of missteps and misdeeds rise to the level of recklessness to allow your complaint to go forward. And is that a matter of law or fact, given, I mean, to make that determination here?
I think it's a jury call, Your Honor. I think we have exceeded the level at which a court should say no reasonable juror could find that under the totality of the circumstances in this case that their conduct was not reckless. I think getting back to the question the court generally does decide immunity issues. However, where there is factual dispute or where there is evidence strong enough to meet that standard, it does become a jury issue.
Counsel, if we could look at it a little bit differently and assume that every fact that you have presented, or every fact is true, and let's assume that everything is true, is it still possible that the court can look at this and say, assuming everything is true, this still does not rise to the level of wanton and willful behavior, because at most we're talking about negligence. We're talking about this horrible situation, the outcome terrible for the child, but we're looking now at the fact that there was an investigation, whether you use the term adequacy, whether it was adequate or not, even assuming everything is true, this is not a situation where it was totally ignored. There was information that was so clear and nothing was done, so that the court itself can make a determination that this situation is not within the category of willful and wanton.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that this case is in that category. And this investigation was a start and a fit, and that was it. There was nothing ever done to monitor this child's safety after the initial interview in the home visit, which occurred within a two-day period. So to say that there was reasonable efforts at an investigation, although those efforts may have been negligent, is far from what the actual facts suggest about what these employees did, and by turning their backs. We believe they did completely disregard their duties in this case.
I thought there was a home, wasn't there a home visit?
That occurred on the following morning, Your Honor.
After the report was
After made. The initial visit with the little girl. However, the little girl wasn't even there at the home visit in the morning.
You're suggesting that there should have been another home visit, follow-up home visit?
There should have been periodic monitoring of this child. If they were going to keep her in the home, knowing what they knew about her injuries and about the fact, and they knew that the boyfriend lived there, and that he refused to be interviewed, and that the mother was also hostile, if they were going to leave her in this home, there's obviously, and which is what they chose to do in this case, not that we agree with that situation, but in developing a safety plan, they did nothing that would meaningfully ensure this child's safety. They simply put her back in the status quo and walked away. There was no
they
further
required
contact.
They required her to have a medical exam, didn't they, which the mother agreed to do. And I'm taking the other side to determine whether there are factual issues here, because they claim that, the appellants claim that the mother, LaShawn, who's the mother's sawyer, was cooperating with the agency's investigation. You say she was hostile.
She was hostile, and that's based upon, Your Honor, the caseworker's testimony in the criminal trial of LaShawn Sawyer, which was part of the, we made part of the record in this case.
Well, counsel, the way I'm kind of looking at this is, and you say that they lacked the ongoing investigation, it seems to me that they did an investigation. They came to the conclusion, although it was a very abbreviated investigation, that this child's abused, that she's been physically abused. And one, to me, that kind of concludes the investigation part, and now what they need to do is figure out how they're going to deal with this abuse. And rather than putting the child in a protected environment and doing everything that the case plan and everything would have should have addressed for the child's safety, they put the child in the abusive home and was going to monitor it. Now, that to monitor it, to me, isn't the investigation. The investigation occurred once they came to the conclusion that this child was abused. And the follow-up activity here, I would question whether that raises the level of recklessness here to draw that conclusion. And once that, they didn't need any more investigation to figure out that this child was abused. And at that point, the trigger to report it to the police would have been pulled based on your argument, correct?
Correct.
So what happened afterwards, whether their plan was, had the right parties sitting at the table to decide what they're going to do with this little girl, or the child being placed back in the home, that's all that something that happened after the point at which they determined abuse. And
I agree with you, Your Honor.
I mean, it seems to me that's your best argument here, is at that point, they had a duty statutorily to contact the police. Let the police figure out who's abusing this child. I mean, if it's not readily available, but that's what the police do.
Yes, Your Honor, and I do appreciate and I agree with the distinction, and our complaint does allege not only recklessness in the investigation, but the disposition of this case, knowing what these caseworkers knew.
You've used your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I've noticed now that I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pettinelli. Ms. Sheehan and Mr. Cochran, you saved a little more than 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe there's some factual things that need to be clarified on the record for this court to make a determination. And I would like the court to look at this through the eyes of the supervisor in this case, who can only look at this case through the eyes of the social worker that had hands-on duty with the case. There was not a determination that the child had been abused. In fact, they requested that the child undergo a medical examination by her physician and that there be a report back as to what the results of that medical examination was. From Appellant Monroe's perspective, he received information from the social worker assigned to the case that there was negative for fractures and there was no indication of abuse. Now, by the rules of DCFS—
That's from the medical report?
That's from what was reported to him by his social worker.
But where did the social worker get the information?
Her testimony has been that she contacted the medical clinic and talked to the examining physician. Actually, there was two visits to the medical clinic, one for x-ray examination, the second for a physical examination by another physician there. And that was what was reported back to Supervisor Monroe. The agency has up to 30 days to make a determination in their investigation, and this case fell short by just a few days by this child's tragic death. So at the time that this was ongoing, they had not made the determination of abuse.
At what point, I wasn't clear, maybe I just missed it, did the mother remove the child from Ohio? That was during the 30-day period, I assume, wasn't it?
She made a request to go out of town for a funeral, I believe in the state of Alabama, which she contacted the social worker, and she gave that person permission to go out of town. Now, there's been a lot to be said about whether or not there was continuous contact with the child. The safety plan itself first required the school, if there was any further evidence of abuse, that they should contact the social workers. That never occurred. Unfortunately, one of the unfortunate circumstances here, there was an Easter break, so the child didn't even go to school for about 7 days. The child also went to the state of Alabama after she was given permission to do so for a family funeral. The supervisor in this case testified, and it's unrefuted, that he asked no longer than 3 separate times, has there been another face-to-face contact with the child? And each time the social worker assigned to the case said, I tried, but this happened, I tried, but this happened. And his response was, go do this. Now, the supervisor can only do what he can ask his employees to do in the charge of that investigation. And that makes it much more difficult for Mr. Monroe in this case, because he didn't have hands-on he didn't have a hands-on with this particular case. He had to rely on other information that was available to him. And our point has been, Your Honors, that he considered all of the information that he should have considered in a DCFS investigation. Were mistakes made? Yes, there probably were mistakes made. But the point is, he didn't violate the clear legal duty, which was to investigate in the first instance and consider a number of factors that were relevant to the case. Your Honor, it's very important for social workers in this state to be able to go out and perform their duties. Each one of these cases is fraught with danger, as you might well understand. But they do so understanding that they do have immunity to make those decisions. And I believe it's incumbent upon the courts to first decide what the duty is, find out if it was violated, and then determine whether or not the individual worker had some improper purpose in his animus with the way that he conducted his investigation.
Well, counsel, you say that the supervisor, Mr. Monroe, took the word of the new social worker who is reporting to him that we've got a doctor saying that this child's not been abused.
I think the report was the abuse is unsubstantiated, which is a term of art that they use, and that it was negative for fractures.
What does unsubstantiated mean?
Means that the doctor could not say one way or the other whether or not it was physical abuse.
But wasn't there an eyewitness, the teacher, that said that there was a fist mark on this child's face?
Your Honor, there was a mark on the child's face, and it was photographed, and those photographs were taken back to the supervisor to observe. He could not.
Who said that there was a fist mark on the face?
Maybe the worker there had, I'm sorry, the daycare center worker concluded that it looks like it was a fist mark made on the face. But with that, and at that point, Monroe, the supervisor, asked for medical proof whether or not it was signs of physical abuse because they questioned the child as to whether it had been she had been abused by her mother. She responded no. She acted affectionately towards her mom. All of the other indicators would seem to point out to this supervisor that physical abuse was not occurring with the custodial mother.
And counsel, you had stated animus when you were talking about wanton and willful. And it's your understanding that that would be required before we could look at that particular phrase. Is that right?
We asked the court to adopt a reckless standard that's adopted in many other aspects of the law, a perverse disregard of a known risk. Did Mr. Monroe take these things into account and say, I don't care what happens, I'm not going to do anything? No explanation of this record could show that.
So again, in my question to opposing counsel, even if we assume that every single thing that is alleged were true, the evidence falls short on the willful and wanton aspect of this case.
We believe so, Your Honor. We believe recklessness at least requires that second element.
Thank you.
Counsel, in the appellee's brief with respect to Mr. Monroe's opinion about the mark on the face, there's a page 16, they cite to a memo he sent to the director. His words, I guess, I immediately recognized one photo in particular showing a pattern bruise to the right side of her face. The shape and pattern of the bruise indicated to me that the child was hit on the side of the face with a closed fist. That they say that's a memo from Monroe to Director Denahan. Is that accurate or not accurate?
That memo is accurate, Mr. Chief Justice, but it was written at a time after the child had died and during the
investigation. That's what his response was. I was excited or something, or felt bad, and so he made this statement.
Yes, Your Honor, and
it's a memo. It's not just a blurting out a response or a reaction. It's a memo.
From Mr. Monroe's perspective, if it was hindsight, looking backwards, he was blaming himself for not seeing what he thought should have been seen, given the fact that the child died of abuse. But the point of the matter is at the time that he viewed the abuse and made the decision as to whether or not the child was abused and made the decision whether or not the child should be removed, he did not see that. That would be negligence.
Thank you, Mr. Cochran.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.